Good morning. If you followed, say, the ASCO PH listings over the last couple of months, you'll find quite a number of articles which propose alternative structure formation models, in particular alternative dark matter models like collisional dark matter, warm dark matter, and so on. And it's actually really a boost if you compare it with the years before. And the question is, why has that happened? And one of the reasons for it is that there seems to be a sense that there is a problem with the small-scale structure of dark matter halos. There seems to be a problem with galactic rotation curves. So the question we want to address today is there really a problem? And we will have panel members discussing that issue in about 5-minute presentations. But let me just give you a bit of a background. The whole story pretty much started with a result from numerical simulations that numerical simulation make a pretty clear prediction what the density profiles of dark matter halos are. And there seem to be a universal profile which can be parameterized in that way here, which has essentially one free parameter, which is the concentration parameter C, which is the radius at which the slope of your density profile is roughly isothermal compared to the virial radius of the dark matter halo. At the smaller scale, you then asymptotically go to an r to the minus 1 profile, so a cusp near the center. At large radii, you go to r to the minus 3. And that concentration parameter, if you calibrate it in numerical simulations, you find that for typical cold dark matter type scenarios, you get a ballpark number of 15, plus minus whatever. So, where is the problem? Let me just add a couple of issues here. First of all, the NFW profile predicts that you have a cuspid core with a density profile like r to the minus 1 in the center. But there's a claim that rotation curves, in particular of dwarf and low surface brightness galaxies, are in favor of a flat core near the center. Seems to be obviously a contradiction. Then, well, some people are not that sure about that. But if they try to fit rotation curves with an NFW profile, they find best fits, you need concentrations of about 5, relatively low. Whereas, cold dark or CDM type simulations more predict the concentration parameter, the backpack of 15. So there seems to be, even if the profile may be right, there seems to be a discrepancy between the parameter of the profile as inferred from the observation compared to the theory. Along a similar line, you can study zero point of Tully-Fisher. You find that the zero point of the Tully-Fisher relation also depends on the concentration of that profile. And the best match, again, goes in the direction of a concentration of about 5, where simulations predict something like 15. Another issue with details is that the scatter in the Tully-Fisher is observed to be fairly small. And the question is, how does that smallness of the scatter in the Tully-Fisher is consistent with the scatter in the halo properties, like spin parameter, like concentration parameter? And finally, there seems to be a problem that cold dark matter predicts much more satellites in a halo like the local group than is actually observed. So these are the problems we have to address today. However, there are also some issues about that because it's not all that easy. There's a question is, how good is that NFW fit? There has to be quite some discrepancy what the central shape of the profile, for example, should be, although that more or less converged over the last year. We may hear about that today. Then, there seems to be, as Julio showed yesterday, a discrepancy between rotation curves from H1 versus rotation curves from H-alpha. There is an issue that we don't quite understand at the moment how the C parameter in detail depends on the cosmological parameter. So the question is, can we fine-tune our cosmological parameter so that CDM predicts something like 5 for the concentration parameter, or that number far off anything reasonable. So that then leads to the question, do we really need new physics to solve that problem with the concentration, or can we solve that problem actually by just doing a more proper job? Or maybe there's also an astrophysics solution to the problem of concentrations. Because at the end, the central regions of galaxies are dominated by baryons and not by dark matter. And finally, as Simon mentioned yesterday, also the question for the satellites, how do you actually compare the circular velocity of a dark matter halo with the actual velocity of one of those satellites, and may fine-tuning like that actually solve the problem? So all those questions will hopefully be discussed in today's panel session, and in a time-ordered fashion, the participants is myself, it's Frank Vandenbosch, it's Rob Swatters, Avishai Dekel, Stacey Mikoff, and Joe Bremack. I want to run the session the following way. We have about 5 minute statements of each of the panel members, and after that, give the discussion to the audience. So you are supposed to ask questions either to particular panel members or to the panel overall. Then I hope we have a lively discussion on the issues involved. And so I would like to ask the first speaker, Frank Vandenbosch, to give a short statement.
Okay, what I want to do in these 5 minutes is just address a few problems that there are in trying to use rotation curves to infer something about the density distribution of the dark matter, because that's what people do, and that's where the claims for constant density cores come from. There are actually three important issues. One of them is the effect of beam smearing. People use H1 rotation curves and often do not take into account the fact that there is beam smearing. These effects can be pretty severe, and you have to take that into account. And the best way of doing that is not trying to use the data and deconvolve the data in one way to correct for the beam smearing, because that's mathematically an ill-defined problem, but to take a model, to convolve the model to the resolution of the data and compare the model to the data. That is what I've done for a whole bunch of low surface brightness galaxies, for which the claim was there that they are inconsistent with CDM halos. The most important thing, what I want to point out, is that in doing that, it's actually not on here. In doing that, the actual rotation curve, the actual rotation velocity you measure is a beam smear quantity, and therefore you also have to know what the underlying H1 distribution is, because that's the stuff that weighs the velocity field, and therefore you first have to make a fit to the actual observed H1 distribution, which again is a beam smear quantity. You have to take all that into account, but if you do that, it actually turns out that all these low surface brightness galaxies that have been used in the past to argue against CDM are perfectly consistent with CDM halos. I'm not saying that they're inconsistent with constant density cores. The data is just of insufficient quality to say anything meaningful about these dark matter halos. Conclusion from that is you need higher resolution rotation curves. And there are only a few of them out there for low surface brightness galaxy. The one that I looked at, the one only single one case that I could find, was perfectly consistent with CDM. There are other problems, however, rather than beam smearing, even if you go to very high resolution rotation curves. And one of them is a well-known mass-to-light ratio degeneracy. We don't know a priori what the mass-to-light ratio of a stellar disk is. If you change the mass-to-light ratio of a stellar disk, either it changes the contribution of the dark matter in the central regions, and unless you have a handle on this mass-to-light ratio, you don't know what exactly the central steepness of the dark matter profile is. People always thought that dwarf galaxies and low surface brightness galaxies help you here, because there it turned out that you couldn't crank up the mass-to-light ratio very much, because then immediately the central point, the rotation velocity at the central point would be higher than the measured velocity, which of course can't be true. In other words, the maximum disks that people could fit there were very low mass, and basically they claimed that these systems are completely dark matter dominated. However, here again, this problem with the beam smearing is very important, because it's the innermost point that sets the maximum mass-to-light ratio. It's the innermost point that's most affected by the effects of beam smearing. And actually, it turns out that even low surface brightness galaxies And as Rob will show you, also the dwarf galaxies, if you go to high enough resolution, turn out to have a significant problem with this mass-to-light degeneracy. So we need to somehow get another way of getting the mass-to-light ratio. And in the 3 minutes that are left, I quickly want to point out a third degeneracy, and that's a degeneracy between actually trying to fit a halo that has a constant density core. So I'm using here halos that are sort of a generalized NFW profile. They fall off in the same way as an NFW in the outer part. In the inner part, I have a free parameter set. It's a cusp slope. So for alpha equal to 1, I have an NFW profile. For alpha equal to 0, I have a constant density core. What I'm doing here, I'm plotting two different profiles. One has a constant density core, one has an NFW profile. They're sort of tuned by hand to look similar in the inter-region. As you can see, in the outer parts, they're plotted out to the virial radius. They basically diverge strongly. So they're clearly different profiles. But in the inner parts, here up to about 20% of the virial radius, these things look remarkably similar. Even if I have very good data, even if my error bars on the data are very small, I'm going to have a hard time discriminating between these two models. Of course, the NFW, the one with alpha is 1, has a smaller concentration parameter in order to fit it, but there is a general degeneracy in trying to discriminate between these two, and it's just a matter because we can't probe out to the virial radius. Basically, our H1 or whatever we use to probe the velocity field doesn't go much further than 20% of the virial radius or something. And that degeneracy impairs our ability to try and get out what we put in. In this case, what I've done is constructed the model. I have a disk galaxy, a halo. In this case, I put in a halo with an NFW profile. I put in a certain disk with a mass-to-light ratio of 2. And I ask myself, how well can I recover that actual density distribution of a dark matter halo? If I mimic observations, I beam smear, I do the convolutions, etc. Here, as a function of alpha running from 0 to 2, what I do is I choose alpha, I choose a mass-to-light ratio, and I use chi-squared fitting to find the best fitting concentration parameter in V200. And I'm plotting here the results for 3 different mass-to-light ratios that you put in. There's a larger degeneracy in the mass-to-light ratio. 3 different mass-to-light ratios give you basically the same result. And there's a large area that within the 99.73% confidence levels, I can't say anything about. All these models are equally well. Only if they go to very small... Oh, they're down here. 0, 2, and 4. Whereas I put in 2 was the input value. You need very small errors in the velocity of about 0.2 kilometers per second in order to be able to recover something meaningfully. And it also depends slightly on how far out you probe. And final sheet. You can apply this to dwarf galaxies. Rob Swartes is an excellent example of high quality dwarf galaxy rotation curves. I applied the same machinery to these galaxies. And this is just the first example and the last one that I can show. The same results here. All I want to show is that you don't know the mass-to-light ratio, so you let that free. You see the chi-squared surfaces for 3 different mass-to-light ratios. The question now is, can we rule out NFW? Look at alpha is 1. We're pretty close to the minimum there. Alpha is 1, and you take a mass-to-light ratio of about 2. You find a concentration parameter of about 15, which is what you wanted. The rotation velocity, V200, is about 50. So it's really a dwarf, it's a low mass system. And the baryon fraction that comes out of the order of 4%, which is perfectly fine with a little bit of feedback. So conclusion, there's no problem.
Okay, is there any clarifying questions for Fred? So 0.2 kilometers per second, that was the beam smear data, right? Higher resolution data would need to be quite accurate.
That was in a model, I give it the scatter of 0.2 kilometers per second. No, the beam smear did. Yes, then you can do it. This was for a maximum that is about 10% of the virial radius. So that's the other thing that's important.
So this is what we think, a typical dwarf galaxy looks like. It's DDO-154. It has a rotation curve that rises rather slowly, actually continues to rise more or less to the last measured point. In this particular case, there's some marginal evidence that it actually declines. But the general idea for dwarf galaxies is they have slowly rising rotation curve. At least, that's what we think. Also, if we try to fit, for example, in this case, an NFW halo to the rotation curve, we find that in the central parts, it is very different. Usually, the NFW halo over-predicts the rotation curve. So generally, these are inconsistent with the published H1 rotation curves, at least with most. There are also some other dwarf galaxies available in the literature, like, for example, this particular galaxy, UGC 2259. It has somewhat higher amplitude, but 80 kilometers per second, still pretty low. What we see here is that the rotation curve actually rises rather steeply. And if you want to fit an NFW halo to this particular galaxy, that works pretty well. You find a concentration parameter of order 15 to 20 in this particular case. So it's clear that observationally, there's quite a bit of scatter in the rotation curve of dwarf galaxies. And of course, one particular factor that could play a role in these cases is beam smearing, as Frank also mentioned just a minute ago. And that beam smearing, in fact, plays a role. It's pretty clear from this comparison of H1 observations and H-alpha observations for a number of low surface brightness galaxies, where in black the H1 rotation curves are shown, and in blue the H-alpha rotation curves. And indeed, you can see that on average, or not on average, but in all these cases, the H-alpha rotation curves rise more steeply than the H1 rotation curves. So beam smearing does play a role. And here you can see the size of the beam, the horizontal bar. And you can see that, you know, these galaxies typically have two or three beams in radius, so they're not very well resolved. So does this mean that we shouldn't believe H1 rotation curves? Well, no, that's actually not the case. In fact, it is still possible to derive accurate H1 rotation curves from H1 observations, as long as you take into account the effects of beam smearing. So if you take into account the detailed distribution of H1, the detailed kinematics, and of course the size of the beam, if you take all that into account, it is still possible to derive an accurate rotation curve. It's actually a procedure rather similar to what Frank just described. And when you do that for these, for a number of dwarf galaxies, and I have a sample of about 35 galaxies in my thesis, here I show the results. Here I show the dwarf galaxies with radii expressed in kiloparsecs, and here in scale lengths. Optical disk scale lengths, yes. And what you see in this particular case is that actually for most of these dwarf galaxies, the rotation curves rise very steeply out to about two disk scale lengths and then reach a flat part. So in fact, these dwarf galaxy rotation curves have shapes that are very, very similar to those of spiral galaxies. The dwarf galaxies with a rotation curve that reach a flat part as low as about 50 kilometers per second. And there are actually very few dwarf galaxies that have solid body type rotation curves, and those that actually have solid body rotation curves only extend to about two or three disk scale lengths. So whether or not such a flat part is reached seems to depend more on the radial extent of these rotation curves than on the luminosity. And also because this spreads quite a range in luminosity and quite a range in surface brightnesses, this strongly suggests that the rotation curve shape depends very little on luminosity and very little on surface brightness. So that much for the shapes. I'm going to overwhelm you with quite a number of rotation curve fits. Here I show maximum disk rotation curve fits to all these dwarf galaxy rotation curves. And the contribution of the stellar disk is shown in red. And what you can see that in the overwhelming majority, all these maximum disk fits actually work pretty well. So in all these cases, the contribution of the stellar disk can be scaled to explain the observed rotation curve in the inner parts. So does this mean that these galaxies actually have maximum stellar disks? Well, the inferred mass to light ratios you find are rather high, between 5 and 10. So generally it seems that it is very unlikely that these actually have maximal disks. Another interesting point is that if you try to fit NFW type halos to these galaxies, you also find that this works rather well for most of these galaxies. There are a few instances where it doesn't work, but again, in the overwhelming majority, this again provides excellent fits with concentration indices of about 8 and higher. So before I put up my summary, I want to come back to DDO-154 once more. Julio already showed this plot yesterday, or a very similar version. And here you see the H1 distribution, and what you see is that the H1 actually is in a ring-like distribution with a couple of clumps in the central parts. And this is the situation where beam smearing is rather important. So the reanalysis of the data, the H1 data already showed that the rotation curve can be somewhat steeper. But recently I've Stacey McGowan, Farah Rubin have obtained H-alpha observation for this galaxy, and you find that the H-alpha points are, in fact, much steeper than the H1 curve. And if you now try to fit an NFW halo, you find concentration of about 10 or so in these cases. So, I'll leave you with the conclusions, and I'll stop there.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, or how confident you are you that these reflect or fish on the right star for your region below the ionic gas around, and that leads to things that you can't really start to really look at?
That's absolutely something that, like, you will have to worry about, because essentially the H-alpha is just one slit, and you can't really tell what's going on in there. It could be expanding shells in there. There's one thing that both the approaching and the receding sides are rather symmetrical in this case. It doesn't seem perturbed. You don't see any evidence for things like that happening. So that gives some confidence. But ideally, of course, you'd like to have a 2D velocity field also in H-alpha to answer that question. Yeah.
And also, can you determine the mass light ratio by looking at the ground dispersion we get from details of the disk? That's what we do in our own galaxy, and then get the measure of the So, on the first question, if you assume an MOL, say 1, then what kind of rotation curves do you get for the dark matter itself?
If you assume a mass light ratio of about 1, then you find that all these galaxies are dominated by dark matter. And if you try to measure stellar velocity dispersions, which I've done for one galaxy, it is hard and it's difficult to interpret the data. But these data seem to suggest that a master light ratio of about 1 is the best value.
Right. Now, if you do that and dominated by dark matter, then how do you answer the question? What's the answer to the question originally proposed on MC? In other words, do they fit with NFW profiles?
Yeah, because they're so dark matter dominated. I've shown you the fits with NFW only, which basically gives you an upper limit to the concentration parameter. And if you have a mass of light years of about unity, they are dominated by dark matter, and the concentration parameters are only very little affected by the baryons, basically.
So you typical answer then for
city? It will be somewhat low, but still around 7 or so, as a lower value, and of course, most are higher. Most of the rotation curves that have a falling rotation curve seem to be the ones that have a strong sense of concentration, or at least be very centrally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'd like to see those galaxies. The galaxies that I've seen, I find. Okay, I'll have a look.
Okay, I think we should continue.
I would like to extend the discussion a little bit before the following speakers go back to the inner profile and address a related issue of profiles of halos, namely the angular momentum, which then translates to, then translates everything to the disk profile, which we actually observe eventually. This is work led by James Bullock, who is here in the audience, and done with Dr. Collat, John Primack, based on simulations by Kratzov and Clifton, who are also here in the audience. And what you see here is a universal family of spin profiles, or angular momentum profiles. So what's plotted as a function of specific angular momentum in units of the maximum value for each specific halo, there are 5 different halos here, just typical of a whole range of hundreds of halos we studied. And here is the mass with angular specific angular momentum less than J, the typical thing that people usually plot. And you see that these five halos really obey a family with one parameter, maybe analogous to the concentration parameter, the MFW profile. Here it's a some kind of a contrast parameter, which you call F. What you see in these profiles, and these are the lines that are this function here, J over J node plus J. There's a parameter J node here, and the ratio of J max over J node for this halo, we call F, this contrast parameter or focus parameter. And this is a low one, this is a high one. It's evaluated in big pixels in the halo. So it's not directly related to space, even though we find that that the behavior is pretty much cylindrically symmetric. So it's really pretty much a function of mass in cylindrical shells. But this is not imposed here. This is the actual mass. So it's more general, but it translates to the disk immediately. The lambda parameter is related to this F parameter this way, where J over M is really J node times some function of F, which is this thing. And you see that this is really a nice fit, and this is a nice family. This is a halo in which the inner part also rotates in the same orientation with quite a lot of angular momentum compared to the outer part. We still have more specific angular momentum. In this case, most of the angular momentum is really concentrated in the very outer part. The inner part may in fact even rotate in another direction, sometimes counter-rotating. So this is a coherent angular momentum along this halo, maybe due to several, one big major measure which brought in all the angular momentum. This can be due to two encounters like this, going in different directions, giving us another story in the core and in the outer part. So there is a universal family or simple function with one parameter for angular momentum. That's right. It's all scaled out, but I'll show you in a second, right here, how this parameter F correlates with the total angular momentum. And that's the first time we see any correlation. You know, many of us have tried many times to see any correlation of lambda with something. Here is some correlation, though not so impressive, but a significant correlation. Well, you should have seen the other plots that people try to do with lambda. So this is a major step forward of finding something that correlates with lambda. F does correlate with lambda, and it's in this sense that the typical F here is about 5, but it's scaled with 1 over lambda, and it's in this sense that if you have this coherent angular momentum behavior along the halo, it's typically something that's had a lot of angular momentum. And if you have this contrast, it doesn't work as well. Okay, what we can go and do now is, instead of assuming an exponential disk, assume we don't know what the disk profile is, but we do know the angular momentum profile, and ask what the disk will look like, and that's the answer. So what you see here in the blue curve is a surface density of the disk as a function of radius. If it was as a thermal, it would have been something of this sort, with R naught a function of F and lambda. But for a typical value of lambda, a typical value of the concentration of the halo, and the mass of the disk, and a typical value of F of 5, this is what you get for the density profile in the disk. And as you can see, it's different from an exponential disk, which is this solid curve here. It has a denser core, goes like 1 over R, and it has a bigger tail in the outside. In fact, if you try to fit an exponent to this function, you end up with this exponent giving an impression of a smaller disk than this exponential that you would get from info. Now, this info is conserving angular momentum specifically, and also using adiabatic invariance to follow the reaction of the halo to the disk collapse. I don't know anything about shell protein. I just know about conservation angular momentum. So it's the same thing that you would do when, like, more mine-wide, etc. You assume specific angular momentum is being conserved for each particle or each shell, if you want. and you just let it reside where it's supposed to be in circular rotation in the disk. Okay? Except that here, we're not assuming exponential at the end product. Here we know what the initial product is, the initial Lagrangian profile, so we can follow it self-consistently and end up with the actual profile that we will end up with had it conserved specific angular momentum. Now let me just one word of conclusion here before I answer the question. Well, this goes a little bit towards the direction that we see in the simulations, Hadron simulations of a smaller disk. Okay. On the other hand, it does not explain the low angular momentum. So the ways to explain the low angular momentum still has to do with either calling this part a bulge, so this can be a contribution to the bulge, and then what's left would be the disk, and will be more exponential. Or you have to go to things like what Julio told us yesterday, that you actually need to use feedback to get rid of the low angular momentum stuff, maybe out of the halo or to the outer part before it really collapses, and then end up with a higher angular momentum disk. But the point is that this family of models can really be a very useful tool for anybody who's doing semi-analytic modeling of galaxy formation or this formation, which will relate to what we had before, what we'll hear next. And this family is a very useful tool. It's a very good fit. It's one parameter that you want to add to Lambda and will give you a lot of wisdom about the actual rotation curve count of the disk. Thank you. Very, very rarely, but in few cases. Well, it's really done in big pixels, and the whole angular momentum is measured in a given big pixel. Big, you know, we have, 20 or so pixels. Yeah, so there are many, many particles in each pixel like this. And no, no, it's not always the same. No. It's the angular momentum is always defined along the direction of the actual angular momentum of the whole halo. Okay, so it's really the projection. You first define the axis, okay, and you which is the angular momentum of the whole thing, and then you look at this volume at projection along this line. The rotation velocity in this. That's it. What do you mean? This is. You want to see that you want this to be translated to the velocity as a function to a circular velocity as a function of radius. Well, you can do one can do this, and in fact, I can give you J of R. In this case, it would be pretty much constant velocity case. Okay, so this would be if this is centrifugally supported. If it was very high, it was the same all the way. V was constant all the way. Here, maybe the velocity goes steeper, in a steeper way. Maybe V goes like R or something. Okay? So, you understand what I'm saying? It's something to test. Well, the only thing I can point to is how coherent this behavior is along the whole ring, and it's coherent both here and there in many, many cases. So that's the only thing I'm going to say about possible.
For example, depth versus concentration, this is just a scatter plot.
Yeah.
Yeah, but concentration is not a good indicator. Well,
these are all reasonably well relaxed fields. I don't think there are any that. This is the result for hundreds of fields.
Well, we have not selected. I think it's a good thing to test because there was no selection here based on relaxed or not relaxed. So it's worth it was tested. Sure.
Yeah, I think
we
continue. Okay, well, you've heard much about beam smearing and throughout this whole discussion, I felt a little like the dog in the panel here. So I don't deny it. I'm a sinner. I haven't worried too much about beam smearing because I think the way to answer this question is not to run a bunch of degenerate models of the poor data, but to go out and get better data. So I want to talk a little about these NFW type fits. But if we're going to address the question that's been posed for this panel, we have to agree on what would constitute a problem. And, you know, I've talked about these issues to a lot of different people, and so some plurality of them basically seem to deny that anything would be a problem. So I think there are two things, and one is some specific prediction you can test, for example, the NFW halo, and whether or not the concentration is too low or not for what you'd expect from some reasonable model. But more generally, an issue which I haven't heard discussed here, we've heard a lot about the Tolle-Fisher relation, but we've heard very little about maximum disk. And those two things, there's some tension between them, I think, that's a very general property of rotation curves that we need to understand. Okay, so here are a bunch of raw optical rotation curves. Probably don't show up at all here, but you can see the H alpha bending across through there. I actually asked to Kit Peak the first time to do this 5 years ago and got back the answer that everybody knows the dark matter is out at the outskirts of galaxies, so you don't need high resolution to do this problem. So, you know, I didn't have access to other telescopes, so I just had to wait until I could convince them. Now, Vera Rubin and Erwin de Blok and I have been doing this, so we have a bunch of rotation curves, and you can see just by examination they do not rise very steeply in general. Now, when you overlay them on the H1 rotation curve, some of them rise more steeply than the H1 rotation curves, and some of them don't. It's a really mixed bag, and you have to go through that and do the whole sample before you really get an idea of what's going on. Tim Pickering had managed to do this for one case at 5683, which Rob has also done. In that case, there's basically no difference. Rob's also done at 5741, for which there's a huge difference, biggest difference in the sample. In general, there's a range of answers. Now, I don't have time to show you all of the data, so I will get down to the result. This is the concentration V200 diagram that results from NFW fits to the H-alpha data of the low surface brightness galaxies for which we have H1. Okay,
what parameters are you putting? Mass flow ratio, concentration, and V200?
In the moment, right now, this is just these two with zero disk. So right now, I've assumed no disk and fit concentration and V200. Sorry? So these are upper limits on the concentration. That's correct. And in fact, each of these blobs through here is the 2 sigma confidence contour for each galaxy. So each blob is a galaxy. And indeed, there are some that can tolerate quite reasonable concentrations in terms of, you know, a reasonable cosmology. But there are still a great number that require quite low concentrations, something like 4 or less. And that's still problematic, I think. If you do insert some sort of mass for the stars, you know, take gas in its normal amount. And what in this case we did was just assume a constant mass to light ratio. I think it was 1.2 in the R band, which is still a little bit lightweight for the R band, but something reasonable, then you get basically the same thing, except, of course, the concentration parameters move down very well. You can see V200 is not well constrained, but the concentration parameter is. And as soon as you allow a little bit of mass in stars, then these things get uncomfortably small. And stars have some mass, and so this is still an issue, I think. This is a 2-sigma contour, yes. Okay, so that's where that stands at the moment. That's mostly data we got in June. There's a bit more that we got just last month. We've talked a lot about the Pauli-Fisher relation, so I'll try to go through this pretty quickly. I try to take as an empirical approach as possible to looking at this and come up with something. There are the mass of the disk scales as the fourth power of the rotation velocity. Some measure of, that's what I've called the baryonic Pauli-Fisher relation, this thing on the right, which Julio already showed yesterday. The significant new thing here is all these new data for dwarf galaxies, these green points down here. This really extends the dynamic range over a great larger scale, so you get a better idea of what the slope is. They're also very gas-rich, so basically it doesn't matter what the stars are doing or what extinction is doing. Their position on this diagram is determined by the gas mass, not by the stellar mass. So that slope is 4. And that's something we need to assume. If you just look at the formal fit, then that's different from a slope of 3 at 8 sigma. I've assumed that that's basically negligible, and that's true for what you can see in H2 regions and so forth. You know, if there's some big halo of ionized, hot ionized gas around it, and it doesn't really contribute. What the scaling is between the observed disk mass and anything else. And it seems to me strange to invoke that you could have a lot of other mass like that, since the scaling works so well with just the disk mass. The naive, simple interpretation of that is that this is the intrinsic slope of the relation, and that this product, the relation between disk mass and total mass, is product of the disk fraction, baryon fraction, is constant. If you want to recover a slope of 3, you have to make the disk fraction of baryons a function of circular velocity in a very finely tuned one. And I've run out of time. The thing that really bugs me is that there are no surface brightness residuals in the Pauli-Fisher relation. That's telling you that stars have an insignificant amount of mass. Yeah, very good. So that's this diagram. That's known over a very large thing. If stars were an important component of the mass, then they would deviate from the Pauli-Fisher relation in this way. Corteau and Rick showed that this was true even if you measure the velocities at the peak, where the star should peak in the contribution. So that tells you stars have no mass. On the other hand, maximum disk fits do work. And that's telling you stars do have mass. And I think those two things are a fundamental contradiction that we need to sort out without just denying, just calling one or the other a fluke. Okay, I'll stop there. Well, yeah, actually, I should say you came and visited us a couple weeks ago and you posed that question. So I went and tested it out and made all sorts of really strong functions, made the mass-to-light ratio of the stars, big functions varied by factors of 10 across the observed range. Really doesn't change that much because it's the gas mass that dominates at the faint end. So, you can play with that all you want. The basic answer doesn't change. No, not per se. Some of the dwarfs might count in that thing, and I certainly don't think that's an exclusive sample of dwarfs, but it's the things that we have, the velocities, all the information you need to go into that diagram. And certainly I would expect that the Pauli-Fisher, the standard Pauli-Fisher might fill in, that there are things that don't deviate as much before you add in the gas mass. I understand that, but and I've never, in fact, I mean, I've never been that friendly towards maximum disk because they give ridiculously high stellar mass-to-light ratios for low-surface brightness galaxies. But you do need them in high-surface brightness, something close to maximal disk, to get bars and stuff in high-surface brightness galaxies. And it's also true that since the shape is the same, if you have a submaximal disk, whatever is left over for the dark matter also has a rotation curve that looks like maximum disk. And that's very strange, but it's produced by a circular halo.
Well, you should keep the question because it generates discussion after the presentation. The last speaker for the morning is George.
Well, I want to make four points, which is a dangerous thing to do in 5 minutes. But I want to try to... So, first I want to talk about the arc simulations by Krasov and Klippen and where we really converged. Then I want to go back to James Bullock's thesis work and tell you about the range of concentrations. It's a log normal distribution, so correspondingly there's a wide range of rotation curve shapes. I want to talk about something that's not exactly relevant to the topic here, which is galaxies at z equals zero, but with this large sample studied at many redshifts, we can show what the redshift dependence of concentration is, and it falls off steeply with redshift. And then finally, I want to compare to the Tully-Fisher relation in a different way, which is complementary to what people have done. And the conclusion is that if you don't include baryonic infall, in fact, the velocity function that you deduce from luminosity functions is a little higher than the velocity function coming out of the lambda CDM simulation. If you take baryonic infall into account, then it goes the other way. The theoretical velocity function goes a little higher than the observational one. And this could be a problem. So, this shows the same halo with 120,000 particles, 8 times fewer. The particles are simply grouped together and re-simulated. Then 8 times fewer again, so 64 times fewer. And these are plotted all the way into the formal resolution of the simulation, that is the smallest resolution element. The simulation code refines in all dense regions. And if we believed it all the way up to the formal limit, you see that we haven't converged. It turns out that at 4 resolution lengths, it has converged beautifully. And that's shown in this plot, where we stop the plot at 4 resolution lengths, which corresponds to a minimum of 200 particles inside the first plotted point. So there you see we have exactly the same shape, independent of the resolution.
So there was a region in the first plot that was overshooting the solid line.
Okay, so.
Now, if you go to four times, you don't get the same plot here.
Is that the same data? Is that the same data?
It's the same data.
So we don't draw the point, which used to be.
Maybe you put that for the discussion.
Okay, I want to. Remember, I have 4 points I want to make. So. Now, this is that same halo. This is the poorest of the three. This is the best of the three. Fit to NFW. The NFW fits are practically identical, and in particular, the concentrations are identical within the errors. So, these are both NFW. They're both excellent fits to NFW. This is the high res, this is the low res. Okay? The point I'm trying to make here is NFW is an excellent fit to these simulations once we understand our resolution. Now, this is new. It's been on AstroPH for a while, but for some people at least, this may be the first time you've actually seen. When you have 2,000 halos in a given mass range of only a factor of 2 in mass, around 10 to the 12 solar masses. This is what the distribution of concentration looks like. So you can easily see that the two sigma tails are fairly wide. This is for the lambda CDM model, omega of 0.3, Hubble parameter of 0.7. These are for subhalos. They are a little bit more concentrated. Now, the range of concentration reflects or causes a wide range in rotation curve shapes. This is the median concentration. This is two sigma below. This is two sigma above. These should be quite rare, but that's what would happen if we have such high concentration and such low concentration. This is the paper. This comes from James Bullock's thesis, and this shows the distribution as a function of redshift, the one sigma up, one sigma down, and median. And this is the thin curve is our favorite model that accounts for this. And this is the model that was put forward in the NFW 97 paper, which, as you can see, is not right. It does not fit the redshift dependence at all. Let me make the point a little bit more strongly by showing you a convergence test. This red band, the red curve, and the one sigma up and down are based on 8 times higher mass resolution. And the results are virtually identical, the same within the errors. And so we're pretty confident that this is really correct. This is going out to redshift of 5. The model, well, it's similar to the model that was put forward in NFW. What you do is, okay, I'm not going to have time to describe the model. This works for any cosmology, and it agrees with all the results in all the NFW papers for all the cosmologies tested. This particular one is lambda CDM. Your favorite lambda CDM, Jerry, omega 0.3 or so, H of 70. And this shows, the overlay shows the model. I want to make the fourth point because it's directly related to data. And that has to do with the Tully-Fisher relation. But this is using Tully-Fisher in a somewhat unusual way. Theoretically, it's cleanest to calculate the velocity function of halos. This is my last concern. So the velocity function of halos is this thin curve. The velocity function of the halos that... this is the circular velocity, and this is actually, for the halos, the maximum circular velocity from an NFW fit to every halo versus the spatial density. Okay, so it's the standard velocity function. Now, and this curve that I've colored in orange is if you just look at the halos that don't have resolved substructure, but the resolution limit was 50 particles. We had to actually be able to see very, very clear substructure. So almost all of these are going to have some substructure beyond about here. These would be the groups and clusters. These would be the galaxy halos. Now, these are the interesting new curves. The way these are obtained is by assuming all galaxies are spirals in the luminosity function, and correcting for inclination and putting in a dust correction, motivated by a detailed study of SSRS2, which actually typed all its galaxies so we can really see how well we're doing. But anyway, this is taking 4 standard optical luminosity functions and Gardner's K-band luminosity function, using the corresponding Tully-Fisher relations to convert these into the velocity functions. Now, on this end, we're certainly incomplete. The luminosity functions are incomplete, so you shouldn't trust these flattened velocity functions. Here, we're not counting groups and clusters, so we're certainly incomplete. The range you should pay attention to is around here, 200 to 250 or so. And there's a pretty good agreement between the optical velocity function and the calculated velocity function. If anything, the calculated one, the theoretical one, is a little bit low. It actually agrees quite well with the LCRS. Now, this shows the result of putting in the Mo, Mao, and White baryonic infall. So this is an adiabatic contraction a la Blumenthal et al. And this is the same thing, but with the MD parameter adjusted to correspond to what comes out of some standard semi-analytic model. The point is that when you put in the baryonic correction, you go a little bit high. How much high? Well, a little over a factor of 2. The range in the observations is about that big. Is that a problem? I'm not sure.
Clarifying question?
Yes. What you should do is turn around and ask James Bullock, and he will show you the results for the scale-free simulations. All the ones in your 97 paper are a beautiful fit to the formula. You do have to adjust the fitting parameter of the formula once for each simulation. Then you get a perfect fit, much better than the fit in your paper.
Okay, I think we should open the general discussion. So, if you have a question, ask the question to one particular speaker or to the panel in general, and based on that, you get the microphone. Okay.
Well, I think there is a problem for the concentration parameter still, and that's based on the data that we've just got. I mean, it depends on how many things you look at. No, I mean, no, when we analyze the same data in the same way, we get the same answer.
So it's just different galaxies.
Yes.
Yeah, in my sample, there are no galaxies that show this discrepancy. But my sample is mostly dwarf galaxies, and his is mostly low surface brightness galaxies.
Do you have galaxies both there, or the same data?
Yeah, a few.
Yeah. We have five galaxies in common.
So those become galaxies become a good side of the issue that they have.
They're okay, actually, most of them. There's the one, 5683, which is uncomfortably low that we have in common.
So one thing I want to point out is that in your plot where you showed the confidence levels of V200 and the concentration parameter, all the ones that are inconsistent, that seem to indicate small c, also are the ones that indicate very high values of V200, larger than 200 or 300.
Yes, pretty
and if you calculate what that implies for the baryon fraction of these galaxies, you find values that are less than a tenth of a percent.
Yeah,
so basically what this indicates is that basically the model does not really fit the data. There's
also
something, you can't really state anything about this concentration parameter. It basically says there's something we don't understand about this rotation curve.
Also, it's very important to have a rotation curve that actually extends far enough out to be able to constrain the model. So it may be that some of these galaxies actually only extend to about 2 disk scale lengths.
The concentration parameters, if you assume the NFW model, are pretty well constrained in that plot. If you want to start playing with the inner slope, then you can do that, but that's not NFW.
The target for all of the fitting has been the Navarro-Franken-White profile. But we started with the question of whether or not there was a need for a finite density core. And so I'm wondering if instead you actually fit the same data with a finite density core, if the fits would have been acceptable. In other words, we may have a theoretical prejudice which makes us want the answer to be Navarro-Franken-White, but if you started with no prejudice, would the answer have been acceptable for a finite density core?
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's the reason we did, in fact. And the answer is yes. That's no problem.
That's all
we need.
Sure.
That's all. I wanted to make a comment along the same lines as we've just discussed. In Pickering, actually, did the offer galaxies and has also played very similar games to what the state has shown, and he also hit some simple hypothesis. all scattered, it's all data. And the answer is, again, no. So if you actually put things in serious statistical tests, they don't get out.
I just want to point out that you have to be very careful with saying anything about the best fit. The best fit in almost all cases is fairly meaningful, because the best fit, in almost all cases, the best fit wants to be a constant density core. It's also the case where the best fit indicates zero mass-light ratio. We know that that's unphysical. We know that the mass-light ratio is not zero. So the best fit, just going blindly with the best fit, is very dangerous.
Not what Tim Pickering did. He also tried putting in an mass-light ratio on the plane safety.
But I agree. I mean, the data I analyzed, Robert's data from 20 dwarf galaxies, it is a big mixed bag. But if you believe, as Joel pointed out, you expect the concentration parameter to be fairly large, to reveal a very large scatter. So I'm not, you know, once we find two galaxies that reveal CU4, does that mean that it's wrong? No, that's basically in the tail of their distribution.
Well, I think one of the points that Hans Walter was trying to make is true, that these things don't form a family. You'd expect a family to be defined in this diagram specified by the cosmology, and that there isn't one.
I have a question to the three of you, Stacey, Frank, and Rob, and just on the last point that Stacey made. What you measure, going between what you measure, a rotation curve, and what the theory predicts, you need to make a number of assumptions, in particular that you're actually measuring the circular velocity, that there's no other motion in the gas. And obviously, you have only limited information. Now, let us suppose for a minute that, God forbid, the theory was right, and you look at those rotation curves that do not fit the theory, and you look at the images, all the information that you have available, is there anything suspicious about those galaxies that might lead you to think that you're not actually measuring the circular velocity, but that there are warps or outflows or any other non-gravitational motion? I guess Stacey is mostly the person I'm addressing this question to.
I think it's unlikely. And the reason is as follows, and I didn't quite get to make this point when I was talking, but one of the things we need to understand in the context of galaxy formation is why there is a strong coupling between the observed mass distribution and the observed kinematics. If I have a K-band light distribution and the H1 distribution, I can predict with high accuracy what the rotation curve is going to be. Right? The mass and the light are very strongly coupled observationally. So, you know, that coupling tells me that it seems unlikely that you have any huge deviations from circular motions or non-gravitational forces, etc.
Due to thermal motions, you know, random motions. Like if you take 21 centimeter, there was a cloud moving in our galaxy with this about 10 kilometers per second. It's negligible if you do solar distance, but if you go to the cloud, which is a 1 kiloparsec, that should increase, because if you would like to have a constant height of the gas, that should go higher. You know, it's not much, but nevertheless, goes up to the limit of 20 kilometers per second. The same comes along with the H-alpha finite thickness. At the solar distance, we're expecting something like 10 kilometers per second, because of the central part, constant height implies that we have a high velocity dispersion. We must have, because otherwise the disk will be very thin. And as that will affect your rotation velocity because of asymmetric drift. And for galaxies which rotate lower than 20 kilometers per second, or the deep, which go below 10 kilometers per second. That's a very significant effect. And if you look at the speeds which showed, that every curve which had in the central part more than 40 kilometers per second was nicely fit with Navarro and Zinvar, and with high concentration. Those, like 3109, which dip below 20, produce very, very bad speeds, or very, very low concentration. But here we need to include those effects of toggle motion, so to speak. And another kind of volume with 21 centimeters, we have another agent, which is very significant, that's magnetic field. The height of a 21 centimeter disk in our solar neighborhood, large degree is supported by, not by turbo motions of gas clouds, which is about 10 tons per second, but cosmic rays and magnetic fields. We don't know how fast is magnetic field, but we do expect in the central parts of galaxies, and everything is kind of more boiling, magnetic fields could be even more important. So 21 centimeters is not good in that respect, when it's, especially when it goes below 20 tons per second. But even motion of stars in the central parts could be important.
Well, the magnetic fields, I don't know about, I haven't tested for that. I have tried to make a correction for asymmetric drift in the central parts of these galaxies, and in most of them, at least if you assume that the H1 is the only gaseous contribution to the rotation curve, yeah, then the corrections are rather small.
Yeah, you assume that it's only one.
Yeah.
Mike?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask a simple question. Joel showed the distribution of concentration parameters that had some number of very low concentration halos in it. And Stacy, as I understand it, has found low concentrations in low surface brightness galaxies, which represent a small fraction of all galaxies. And so the question is simply, are these actually consistent results? Could everyone actually be right in the sense that the number of low concentration halos expected from the simulations is actually consistent with the number seen by Stacy? Does anyone know the answer to that?
No. I mean, they're not rare by number, they're rare by mass. They don't contribute a lot to the mass budget, but they're not particularly unusual kinds of galaxies. They follow all the normal scaling ratios, not just relations, not just Tully-Fisher, but also the shape of the rotation curves pretty well.
Well, what I'm wondering is if that's where the discrepancy is in the low surface brightness galaxies, then the question is simply whether the fraction of mass under that distribution is equal to the fraction of mass in the low surface brightness galaxies. That's the question.
Well, all those concentrations were less than 4, say, so.
Well, let me ask a question another way. What fraction?
Precisely the ones that have high
yeah.
and low concentration that you would expect to form the low surface brightness
balance. Right. So the question is, what fraction of the mass, according to your distribution, would have to correspond to the low surface brightness galaxies that Stacy's observing, in order for there to be consistency?
Good question. It's hard to answer without doing a careful job. It's not obviously a problem.
I'd like to make a bit of a statement, and that is that now we've looked at about a couple of hundred rotation curves. We being we've looked at a couple of hundred, I would say, rotation curves of the last decade or so, comprising the thesis dissertations of a number of PhD students. Rob is the latest. And I think if we've learned anything from these 21 centimeter line rotation curves, it's that, you know, if one plays this game of fitting maximum disk that the maximum disk width becomes better as the surface brightness of the galaxy increases. That is to say, high surface brightness galaxies, you can get a very good maximum disk width, at least to the inner parts of the rotation curve, where you can actually explain you can reproduce even wiggles in the rotation curve. And the mass to light ratios also become very reasonable. The implied mass to light ratios are 1, 2, or 3. Whereas in the low surface brightness galaxies, that's the implied mass to light ratio, if you try to fit a maximum disk, is very, very large, often 10, 20. Now that suggests, of course, if one wants to view it in terms of dark matter, that low surface brightness galaxies inside the visible disk are clearly dominated by the dark component. And high surface brightness galaxies inside the visible disk are not. Now I find that's the fact that there's a single Tully-Fisher relationship with a slope of 4 for all of these, extending from low surface brightness to high surface brightness galaxies is interesting in that regard. I mean, that's another question. But in general, I would just like to say that, we fit not necessarily NFW profiles, but we fit Hernquist model profiles to a number of these galaxies. And there certainly seems to be no problem reproducing the shape of rotation curves if one is willing to allow, let's say, both parameters to be free, the scale length and the concentration. Would the panel members agree with that statement?
I think so, yeah. If you can make the concentration arbitrarily low, then you have room for the cusp. I would actually like to add one more thing to Mike's point. I did actually do the exercise of looking up somebody's distribution. I didn't use you guys. I actually used James' log normal distribution for and basically all of my galaxies are 5 sigma away. So if you want to live with all those things being 5 sigma things, then
but how do you couple C to the low surface brightness galaxies?
Lambda
is much more important. The spin parameter is much more important in determining whether it's going to be a high or low surface brightness galaxy than the concentration.
But that's not correlated with the concentration parameter, if I understand what the simulators are saying.
Let me make a point, perhaps that has been missed here. When we compare the concentrations that Stacey, for example, derives by looking at the inner regions of a halo as traced by the H1, and when we look at the simulations in which we derive the concentration by looking at the outer regions of the halo and try to match the radius where the profile turns over from an R to minus 3 to an isothermal sphere. And those are essentially we're measuring numbers which are constrained in very different regions. In other words, you can have a halo which has a given concentration, but if it's not exactly NFW, and as I showed yesterday in my talk, there is reason to believe that there will be, a sun scatter in the inner slope as well. You can have something that will have a given concentration as measured by a fitting procedure, but in the inner regions it will look like a low concentration halo because its profile is slightly shallower than NFW. So all those issues, I think, require that we take into account before jump into very strong conclusions. And it wouldn't surprise me if that is the reason through which many of these very low concentration fits arise. I cannot prove that, and I think that would require some work, but it's perhaps actually worth doing.
Well, it could certainly be, because you don't know for any individual galaxy.
But we know there is scatter, is that right?
So we know there's scatter, but on the other hand, there are these uniform relations that this goes back to the coupling between the mass and the light. The light distribution, basically every galaxy that has that same light distribution is going to have the same rotation curve. All right, so if, the dark matter halos are dominant and this inner slope is fluctuating around, that seems very surprising, and it seems surprising that these type of galaxies should always end up on the one side of this
curve. David, then Paul, then Jerry.
Well, I just want to ask, since Ben Moore has been heavily involved in this debate from the beginning and wasn't on the panel, are you willing to make any comments? I've been burning to know what your reaction is. Yeah.
Why is everyone looking at me?
That's very interesting. The data being scrutinized, we've spent the last 5 years scrutinizing the simulations and converging on some results by playing around with circles. I think Julia's point is interesting, that when you do these fits, you're fitting to the data in there. That's not much of halos, and what you're really interested in is the inner region. And we don't actually see small samples of very high resolution halos and scattered in the properties of the dark matter in the central region. And the dark matter always has a very steep slope of about minus 1.5, which seems to be the case in other people's high resolution studies, such as Gain and Walter Pringle's work. So, what else can you say?
I just wanted to point out, in the midst of this discussion, where we're trying to determine whether the NFW profile or even something steeper in the core is in agreement with the data, part of the underlying premise is that we might lose a great deal of the successes of the CDM model if we had to sacrifice that prediction. And I wanted to point out that there's a poster paper outside which shows that if one is willing to make the assumption that the halos that form are isothermal and then solves for the equilibrium structure that results from that assumption, that the distinction between that non-singular isothermal sphere that results for the halo and the Navarro-Franken-White profile is actually very small except in this core, and that a whole range of successes of the model in matching the properties of from dwarf galaxies on up to X-ray clusters are retained, only sacrificing the disagreement about the singular density profile in within about 1/30th of the virial radius.
You know, that may well be. I mean, if you have a flatter core, then it's acceptable to the data. I mean, this whole debate about the cusp is actually just the tip of the iceberg to me. And the real problem that forming galaxies faces in this kind of cosmogony is the resultant coupling between the mass and the light. Right? You have to be able to run your simulation or whatever and end up with, you know, a real mass distribution for the stars and the gas that you can then go back, interrogate that, and predict the rotation curve without reference to the dark matter that's actually producing it. And that's just, it drives me crazy. But we have to address
it. Actually, maybe I could ask you a question, Stacey. Along these lines, you've been advocating, as I understand it, the MOND approach. You say that's a perfect fit to all your data. At least that's in your latest published paper. On the other hand, Julianne Dalcantin, and I think Frank is a co-author. Okay, well, anyway, Julianne has presented a set of low surface brightness galaxies, these edge-on ones for which she has H-alpha rotation curves, for which she says this is a clear contradiction. Could you comment?
Yeah. It's unfortunate that Julianne is not here, so we can't hear it from her.
I have not seen those data in any way that I can test, so I can't really comment directly on
that. But she has a preprint on AstroPrint.
I saw a few of the pictures, yeah. And, she had asked me specifically if I would look at the data and do the same exercise to see if we got the same answer, and I haven't got the data, so I can't do that. If the rotation curves really are as shallow as they seem to be, then it's a big problem for both MOND and something like an NFW profile.
Okay.
They are very shallow. On the other hand, these are edge-on galaxies, and I started to describe this experiment of Vera Rubin, and I got three sentences in. Which, you can't do that. They're edge-on. The classic result is there's any optical depth at all, then sine I and cosine I cancel out, and you aren't seeing the actual kinematics. Now there's some hope, I think, in these cases that that's not the case because there's fairly little dust in LSBs, not zero, but little. So maybe you're not completely killed by this. But even then, you have to do some fairly elaborate modeling of what the actual emission distribution is and how it's extincted, because you're looking along, your line of sight is not just tracing the major axis, the kinematic major axis. So it's blurred by motions in and out. So it's very hard to recover back to the initial thing. So, I think that modeling problem is even harder than modeling the 21 centimeter observations, which I tried not to do.
Jane? This is really a historical comment. I think it's pretty clear that the observational data at this point is not of sufficient quality to distinguish between these hypotheses. That's a reasonable summary. My guess is if we look back in 5 years, there'll be two elements of this debate which will seem very bizarre. One is the use of the maximum disk model, which is clearly wrong because it's a bound. And what we should be doing, from what we learned yesterday on star formation, is that M over L is typical for star formation in many different regimes. You just put in a reasonable value and see what comes out. That's consistent with what Bob said. So that what we'll do is just be putting in reasonable values for M over L from the stars and then proceeding. So that will turn out to be a red herring. And the use of concentration parameters is also bizarre. It comes out of the theoretical simulations, but it has no bearing on the observations because people can't see out to this ill-defined virial radius. There's no observation which tells you anything about that. And so we're debating in some mythical space where there's no measurement.
Want to comment?
Yeah, but you can talk about the rotation curve parameters like Vmax and the radius where it occurs, and you can translate in the NFW profile, you could translate the concentration parameter to this parameter. So you can be closer than that to the observation if you want.
You can, but that involves a series of assumptions about the observation for which there's no justification.
Well,
actually, that extrapolation is back to the classic line, if my grandma had wheels, she'd be a trolley car.
No, actually, all you need is two parameters, and those two are good enough to determine the parameters. The problem is that the rotation curves don't usually extend out to Vmax. If the rotation curves extended out to the radius where the maximum velocity occurs, then it would be perfectly good and would uniquely...
So what, I think?
There are dozens that do, but not the ones... Those are mostly for big galaxies. There are only a few where we think they're dark matter dominated, where you actually go far enough out that you're constraining. So, I basically agree with you, but you don't have to go anywhere near the virial radius. Going out just to the radius where Vmax occurs is good enough.
Isn't the fundamental problem for NFW halos, or maybe any halos, not the rotation curve, but the angular momentum problem that was pointed out yesterday? That is to say, one is just making disks that are too small. Now, is that intrinsic to NFW, or is that a problem with halos?
It's part of your argument cluster.
And is there any way around this problem? Ways around it in the context of this table?
Well, I would say no one has solved it.
It's not fundamental. There is enough angular momentum there. You have to avoid losing it.
Yeah.
So, do you create enough angular momentum through the higher cluster process? Problems to rotate it while this final settles this current state. So, how fundamental is it? Which aspect of the process?
All right, time is pretty much up. It's time for a coffee break. We're going to reconvene at 10:50.